Hello and welcome to the YAMP podcast, the show where we discuss the latest trends, research and insights in the entertainment industry. My name is Manal Mota. I'm a research director here at Amper Analysis, and I'll be your host for today. On today's show, we'll be looking at streaming platforms' pivot from pure subscriber acquisition to profitability, and on the back of this, changes in content strategy, particularly the Netflix and WWE deal. We'll be speaking to Guy Bisson and Rory Goodrick. Rory and Guy, welcome to the show.
You're listening to the AMP podcast from Ampere Analysis. To learn more about Ampere's research across the media, games and sports industry, head to ampereanalysis.com.
So the streaming platforms have been leading the boom in spending on content over the past few years. However, recently we've seen a shift in strategies as they move from pure subscriber growth to profitability. Guy, I want to start with you. What's prompted this shift?
Just to be clear, they're not quite there yet. I think they are heading towards profitability, and our prediction is that all of the major studio streamers will hit profitability within 18 to 24 months. I think the shift in strategy, which has set them on the pathway to profitability, was driven and kicked off initially by the somewhat negative quarters that Netflix suffered. And the change in approach to content spend and to staffing costs, which are the big two cost centers for all of the streaming operations. So there was a combination of factors, including the cost of living crisis, the economic downturn, the saturation effects of streaming platforms in their biggest and most profitable markets, and a call from Wall Street and other investors that profitability should be the aim of the streaming companies. I think before that, they were very much in the growth at all costs phase. And that's what led us to the era of peak TV. But that, of course, has now begun to reverse.
And how are the streaming services going to achieve this? Are there different strategies for the different ones?
I think the strategies are fairly similar. It's about cutting costs and rationalizing things like content spend. So with the end of peak TV, we're seeing not a reduction in spend, but certainly a reduction in the rate of growth of spend on content. And we've also seen across the studio business as a whole, quite significant staff cuts. That is their other big cost center. This combination of cuts will set them on the pathway to profitability, even though growth in terms of customer numbers is increasingly hard to come by.
And where does advertising fit into all of this?
So advertising is certainly a big part of the strategy now, and that really came online about the same time as all of these other factors were happening. So we saw the slowdown in subscriber growth, the new approach to content spend, the staff cuts, and of course, the wholesale adoption of advertising. Netflix, but now Amazon, and of course, all of the studios were already heading in that direction. So looking at the outlook for advertising, I think much of the growth that we are going to see in terms of revenue going forward will actually be driven by the uptake of advertising tiers and the extra revenue that that potentially generates.
And Rory, just coming to you there, are there going to be differences in the streamers when it comes to the revenue that they're going to be able to generate from that outside?
Yeah, I think if we look at the advertising revenues that these hybrid tiers are generating in the US especially, by 2025, we estimate that these are going to account for around about $14 billion, which works out to around about 20% of their total revenues if you're including subscription revenues in there as well. So it's certainly not a small amount. I think it's interesting to look at the different sort of strategies that the different streamers have used. So if you take Netflix, for example, they took a fairly measured approach, introducing a very cheap tier, which users could opt to take, and obviously timed that around its account sharing crackdown. However, when Amazon put adverts onto its service, it made ads compulsory for pretty much every single subscriber unless you pay an additional fee. Having said that, I watched American Fiction on Amazon Prime last weekend, and I think I got served a 10-second ad over the whole 2-hour film, so I can't really complain too much.
You are now the third person in a week to have mentioned American Fiction to
me.
So I feel like, yeah, it needs to go on the list.
Yeah.
It does make me wonder, we've had a generation of people, well, say like the last 10 years or so, who've grown up with no advertising whatsoever, or like the option at least to have no advertising through these streaming services. And so we've created a cohort of people who maybe are a bit more averse to advertising. And it will be interesting to see whether or not the Amazon strategy of making everybody watch it will be able to bring some of those people back in and keep them engaged during that time.
Yeah, and I think it depends which markets you're looking at as well, right? I mean, obviously the US, the UK, parts of Europe, they're quite ad mature markets. It's places where people, I think, are fairly used to watching adverts. So I think in those markets, it could work. I think outside of those, it's something that is going to remain to be seen, really.
Do you think that the YouTube generation really have grown up without advertising? And that I think the other thing I'd say about that is that all age groups are still watching linear TV where they are exposed to advertising. So I do wonder if they are quite so ad-averse as perhaps some people may think.
I think I was kind of thinking from it from a personal perspective in that we watch a lot of linear TV in my household, but we have a DVR. So we record everything for the first 15 minutes to ensure that we can fast forward through all the advertising. So actually, even though we probably watch a disproportionate amount of linear TV, we are very rarely exposed to the advertising that's on it. So I guess it just depends what cohorts you're going after and what their viewing habits are at the moment. So Guy, I just want to pivot back to something that you mentioned a bit earlier, which was this reevaluation of content spent. Now, are there types of content that the streamers are cutting back in particular?
I wouldn't say there's a general type that is the main victim of any of the cutbacks. I think it's more of a evolution of strategy that perhaps is doing several things. One of those things is embracing some lower cost programming, some lower cost formats and unscripted programming, which is increasingly prevalent and important in the commissioning strategies of the streamers. But they're obviously still making high budget drama. And we've seen recently with Three Body Problem on Netflix that they're still releasing even fairly high budget and ambitious sci-fi content. But they're also looking at different demographics to target in terms of their growth strategy. And that's also led to something of a shift in the commissioning, particularly around crime content, which is of interest to some of those older demographics where they do still have headroom for growth.
And are we seeing differences regionally here? For example, are the cutbacks centered mostly on the US or anywhere else particularly?
Well, again, I don't think it's a direct result of the cutbacks. I think we're seeing, again, an evolution of strategy that is partly driven by the internationalization of content. And that means that more and more is being made outside the US. But I think that's almost a separate issue. It was happening anyway. And yes, often those areas of production are lower cost than the US. But I think that that was more of a strategy around following the growth. So as the US was one of the first markets to become saturated, the streamers, of course, looked to international for their growth, and thus the programming and the commissioning strategy followed. And that's really the driver of that change.
So then just kind of picking up on that a little bit, if you were a linear platform in one of those markets where they are increasing some of their commissioning slates and going after some of these genres, which I would argue is traditionally more public broadcaster or just traditional linear TV, would you be a bit worried that the streaming platforms are pivoting their strategies towards these genres?
I'd be more worried about the fact that they're now competing for my advertising dollars. I think there's a big difference between the streamers and things like YouTube. So obviously we've seen over the last decade or more a migration of advertising spend to online video, in inverted commas. But much of that has been driven by social media, which is a very different content experience to premium long-form content that is viewed on the big screen, which of course is what the streamers offer and what the broadcasters offer. So that would be, to me, as a local broadcaster, the main threat. And then the content strategy change is almost an extra part of that. I think we'll see the streamers evolve their strategy to an increasingly generalist type content strategy now that they do have advertising. But that in combination with just the fact that they're now chasing the ad dollars for that long form, big screen experience. And they can offer both types of advertising, the heavily targeted advertising that social media has traditionally offered, and the brand building, more general, broad audience advertising that television has traditionally offered. So a big, big change for everyone whose income is dependent on that ad dollar.
So Guy, I just want to go back to some of the streaming platforms in a little bit more depth. Which of the streaming platforms is likely to pull a profit first and why?
According to our models, it was really a race between Warner and Disney. We suggested that Disney would get there first. Now, they've actually said themselves that they will be profitable by fiscal year end, which is the third quarter calendar-wise this year. Our model suggested that they should easily achieve that and could even get there one or two quarters earlier. Warner would follow a couple of quarters later. So those are going to be the first, and then we'll see Paramount and NBC Universal follow sometime after that.
So based on all of that, once these streaming services start pulling in a profit, do you think we'll see some reverses in some of those spending cutbacks that we've seen over the last 12 months or so?
I think it's safe to conclude that we're never going back to the peak of peak TV, those heady days when there seemed to be endless amounts of money for pretty much any project that was out there. So I think the answer is somewhere in between. We will, when the investors are a little more happy about the streaming business model, some of that pressure that has been on the streamers will of course be eased. And that will have a knock-on effect on where they're putting their money and how quickly. But I don't think we're ever going to go back to the absolute peak of peak TV. And so we will see a recovery of sorts, but it will not be anything like we saw during the pre-pandemic and pandemic days.
Thanks, Guy. So it looks like we're past peak TV. And actually, as we move on over the next couple of years, the streaming landscape is going to change significantly through both the advertising side and the type of content that they're going to be creating. So we've been talking a lot about profitability so far on the show. And one of the first streaming services to turn a profit was Netflix all the way back in 2003. The last area of entertainment that we're seeing streamers enter now is sports. We've seen it through Apple and their MLS/MLB deal, Amazon and NFL as well. And one of the big stories recently was Netflix buying the rights to WWE from 2025. Now, firstly, Rory, can you talk me through this deal with Netflix? What does it entail?
Yeah, so in January this year, Netflix announced it has signed the rights for the WWE in the US, the UK, Canada, and Latin America. And basically, the deal is to bring the WWE's flagship show, the three-hour Monday Night Raw, to the streaming service starting in 2025. The deal's been signed for 10 years at $500 million a year, so it's quite a commitment from Netflix. But Netflix have the option to break this after just 5 years or extend it for an additional 10 years. And yeah, as you said, this is the biggest shift that we've seen from Netflix into sports and live streaming. Up until this point, really the furthest that Netflix have gone with live sports has been a series of one-off events. So we've had the Netflix Cup earlier this year, the Netflix Slam last year, and the recently announced Jake Paul versus Mike Tyson boxing match, which is airing this summer.
So why now? Why have Netflix decided to partner with WWE?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the big question, right? Like, why get into sports and why get into it now? And I think it's a really interesting question. 2 years ago, as you remember, when Netflix dropped subscribers for the first time in over a decade, I think it made Netflix and kind of the whole industry stop and think this subscriber growth that we've seen over the pandemic over the last few years maybe isn't going to last forever. And its priorities have sort of had to shift away from pure subscriber growth slightly more towards revenue generation. Netflix has to focus a bit more on monetizing their subscriber base and trying to reduce churn from the subscribers that it does have. But churn reduction is a really big one. And I think this is kind of where the deal fits in for Netflix. So the WWE runs throughout the entire year. And this continuous stream of premium sport content can help to engage viewers and help reduce churn. But those popular live streamed events also generate really high levels of engagement and hence drive quite high advertising impressions. I think it's a really interesting time for Netflix. With the inclusion of advertising on the service, sports kind of makes sense in a way for Netflix like they haven't really done in the past.
Actually, when you talk about churn reduction there, I'm thinking of myself because I'm a lapsed WWE fan ever since it went behind, I think it was on Sky or TNT here in the UK, and I just haven't watched it in years, but actually the prospect of it being on Netflix is quite exciting. Guy, I just want to bring you in here because we were obviously talking a lot about the streaming platforms moving into advertising, and Rory touched on it there as well. But what is it about live sport that has the potential to improve that advertising proposition for Netflix?
I think in terms of advertising, there are several things that you need to do in order to keep that revenue stream sustained. So you need, first of all, you need people to watch. Secondly, you need them to watch in large volumes. And thirdly, you need them to keep coming back. It's not really great if they just watch as a one-off. So when you're looking for content and programming that's going to service the advertising market well, live sport is particularly strong and important. It's got typically a dedicated fan base who are going to try to watch as much of it as they can. They are going to come and watch, obviously, when it's live, so you know exactly when they're going to be watching, and they are going to keep coming back. And depending on the sport, the seasons can run for much of the year. And I think with WWE in particular, the fact that it's of interest to Netflix, one of the reasons is that it will run throughout the year and keep repeating and keep bringing back the fan base in a consistent way. And that's great for generating advertising spend.
So Rory, just coming back to you, what do you think it is about the WWE in particular that made it the first, I'm going to say, quote unquote, sports acquisition for Netflix?
Yeah, I mean, it's sports adjacent.
Yes.
Right. I think it's probably the right term. I think there are a few things, really. I mean, Guy mentioned the seasonality of it. It runs throughout the year. That's obviously going to be very attractive to someone like Netflix who want to have that kind of constant content. The WWE is a competition with high levels of engagement internationally as well. I think it's important because Netflix is a global streamer. It's kind of one of the only truly global streamers. And the content deals that it often does reflect this. It doesn't often go hyper-local. It tends to go cross-regional or global when it looks at its content. And I think sports is going to be no different from that point of view. So I think having something that has global appeal is really important. The other big reason is the content agreement. The WWE has a huge back catalogue of content, over 17,000 hours of old shows and documentaries, etc. This is really good because it can help drive non-wrestling fans to the WWE, but it can also engage those wrestling fans in between the live shows. And the other big thing with this content is that it's going to give Netflix the ability to create its own unique series based off WWE, which they'll hope will obviously drive engagement even further. I mean, we've seen Netflix have huge success with this in the past with shows like Drive to Survive. The difference here is that they actually own the rights to the WWE, unlike Formula One, so they'll see some return on that investment. And finally, something that hasn't really been talked about that much is the length of this deal. Anywhere between 5 and 20 years, it basically means that Netflix can invest in the WWE without worrying they're going to just price themselves out of a deal renewal in a few years' time.
Now, I just want to go back to one of the things that you mentioned, which was around all that ancillary content that they're going to be getting. I think you said it was like 17,000 hours or something like that. Now, are they buying the rights to the WWE just to use some of that content to fill out their catalogue? Or are there other ways that they can actually monetize that directly?
Yeah, so I think the catalogue content is obviously a big one. But I think there's going to be really three main ways that this deal is going to make sense financially for Netflix. The first we've already touched on, and that's churn reduction. So in my report, I looked at the 11 million Netflix households in the launch markets who say they're fans of wrestling and basically calculated the amount that Netflix would save if it reduced churn from these subscribers alone. We also looked at subscriber acquisition. So looking in particular at the 25% of WWE fans who don't take Netflix within the country as it's launched, and how much Netflix could make if it was able to convert those fans into paying Netflix subscribers. And finally, I looked at the advertising revenue that Netflix could generate from this weekly live content. And all in all, we calculated that in a best case scenario, Netflix could make up to around $750 million per year with these rights in the first year alone. So considerably above the $500 million that it paid for the rights. That is the best case scenario, but I think it is feasible that they could break even in the first year alone with these rights.
That's an astounding number. We've kind of looked at this quite a lot from Netflix's perspective as to why they've gone and bought from the rights. But if we flip it a little bit, what's in it for WWE? Why is Netflix the perfect partner for them?
Yeah, I think it's two things, really. I think it's the price and the reach. The current value of the rights that Netflix have signed, we estimate to be around $350 million. By 2025, looking at some other similar deals signed in the US, we could see that appreciating to around $450 million. So at $500 million, Netflix are paying slightly above current market value for the rights. So I think the price is one thing. The other main thing is reach. So whilst Netflix could be considered a bit of a risk as a first-time sport entrant, you can't deny 260 million subscribers across the world is a huge amount of reach, really kind of unmatched by any other streaming player that the WWE could partner with. The WWE is pretty popular in the US, but internationally, I think the ability to grow engagement abroad is really, really attractive. So reach is one thing, but I think something we already mentioned was the ancillary content is a big part of this deal for the WWE as well, not just for Netflix. And I'm sure the WWE will be hoping that Netflix will be able to make content similar to something like Drive to Survive that could boost its popularity even further.
And then I guess WWE has other ways to monetize them as well, right? Because you have all these live events. So if you can start taking these live events on the road to try and tap into some of these fans, you're monetizing through live events as well as the live rights as well. And so then to wrap this section up, where does Netflix go next when it comes to sport? If we say hypothetically they're going to continue this investment in sports rights, what do you think is the next one they're going to go to?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting one. Netflix haven't said explicitly that they're investing in any other sports rights at this time. But as we mentioned before, whilst in the past there wasn't so much of an incentive for Netflix to get into sports, I think with advertising on the surface, it makes a lot more sense. So yeah, to think about other sports rights that Netflix might look at, we looked at the current deal with the WWE and basically just assessed some of the metrics which I believed were sort of important for Netflix in this deal. So things like international enjoyment, the sort of seasonality of the league, cost of the rights, and that potential for ancillary content. Using this criteria, I narrowed it down to three sports really that I think make the most sense for Netflix at this time. And those are the UEFA Women's Champions League, the ATP Tour, and the international rights to the NBA. The UEFA Women's Champions League, I think, would be a really interesting opportunity for Netflix. Women's football has seen a huge increase in popularity in recent years. With the Euros and then the World Cup last summer, the international reach from Netflix would just take this to another level. So I think that would be a really interesting proposition for Netflix. The ATP Tour was another one I mentioned. So this is basically all of the biggest tennis tournaments, excluding the Grand Slams. So things such as Indian Wells, Miami Open, the Canadian Open, for example. And the advantage of this is there are some huge names in tennis that you can make content around. But also the competitions span a range of time zones throughout the year. The ATP Tour, it starts out in the US, but it goes to Europe, it goes throughout APAC. And I think it would make it a lot easier to engage those audiences in those countries that way, especially if the content's live. And then finally, we looked at the international rights to the NBA. So the domestic rights in the US would be probably a bit too expensive for Netflix at this time. Internationally, they're slightly more affordable, especially for how popular the league is. The NBA has some of the highest levels of engagement internationally of any of the sports leagues that we survey in our consumer service. So it's huge in Latin America or in APAC, for example. So this could make a lot of sense for Netflix as well. And then similar to the ATP, in terms of additional content, I mean, you've got some of the biggest stars in the world playing in the NBA.
Yeah, the NBA is a really interesting one. We were actually presenting at a conference last week and we were talking about how, because the NBA rights are obviously up for renewal at the moment and they'll probably sign like a 10-year domestic deal. And when you compare international versus domestic rights proportions, the NBA does relatively well. I think around 22% of their rights come from international, from our sports media rights service. But the opportunity for those US leagues now is really international. And are pay TV platforms the right partners to be choosing? I mean, if it's all about growing the popularity of your sports, and if Netflix or any of the other streaming platforms show a bit of interest and you can democratize the viewing of live sport, it's kind of a bit of a no-brainer there.
Yeah, I think as a value proposition to a sports rights body, Netflix is very attractive because of that global international reach that it can provide to something like the NBA, the WWE, for example.
Thank you so much, Rory. I, for one, am going to be very excited when WWE hits Netflix in early 2025. Well, that's all that we have time for. Thank you very much to all of our guests for their time and for sharing their research today. We heard from Guy about streaming platforms and their shift towards profitability, and Rory about the Netflix and WWE deal. If you haven't done so already, make sure you're subscribed to the AMP podcast as well as our weekly newsletter. And for more research and services, head to amperanalysis.com or get in touch by emailing info@amperanalysis.com. That's info@amperanalysis.com. I'm Manal Moda, and I've been your host today, and the producer of this episode was Rory Goodrick. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and thank you very much for listening.